Evans, Project Manager Extraordinaire, and her awesome team of regional engagement leaders, including Jessica Kleissen, who's hosting our satellite location today in Kelowna, and Tina Biello, who is in our Victoria location, together with our research partner, National Research Corporation Canada, managed every aspect of this project, including the inevitable challenges that arose. But make no mistake, it was Isabel McKenzie's vision that resonated with our project team and with our volunteers. Our volunteers who conducted interviews in every region of the project province. What was that vision? That every resident living in long-term care and their most frequent visitor would be given an opportunity to provide feedback to help ensure that the quality of residential care in this province is something we can all be proud of. I am so very proud to work in a province and with people who value the voices of the people we serve. Thank you, Isabel, for the opportunity to partner with you and your office in conducting this survey of the most frail seniors in British Columbia. I'm delighted to be your MC today as you share the results of this landmark survey. So some housekeeping details before we begin. Just a reminder for those of you who are joining us via the webcast or on the teleconference, the report and the Seniors Advocate's presentation have now been posted online at seniorsadvocatebc.ca under Reports and Publications on the bottom left-hand corner. A few additional housekeeping notes. After the Seniors Advocate's presentation of the results, I will be moderating questions. Those on the webcast will be able to ask questions throughout the presentation via the chat box on the right-hand side of your screen. A reminder to those of you on the telephone, any questions can be directed to info@seniorsadvocatebc.ca. And if you're using social media, Twitter, we invite you to join the conversation using #ResCareSurvey. For those in the Vancouver location, washrooms are just down the hall to your right outside the door. Following the Seniors Advocate's presentation, there will be a chance to celebrate our volunteers with refreshments. You will be invited by table to the buffet by your host in each of our locations. I will now turn it back to our Seniors Advocate, Isabel McKenzie.
Thank you very much, Lena. Okay, we want to have the slides on the screen, not me. Thank you. Well, today we celebrate and we deliberate. So first we celebrate. Over the past 2 years, we have mobilized a small army of people who are committed to making certain that the 27,000 plus seniors in BC who live in residential care spend their final years with as much dignity, meaning, and enjoyment as possible. From the thousands of family members who responded to surveys, to the care home operators who opened their doors, from frontline staff who provided input and insights into how and when we should talk to residents, to the policymakers who supported this mammoth undertaking by ensuring all the rules and regulations were followed, to the government who funded the initiative, to the staff at my office at the OSA who kept the focus on the mission, to the regional volunteer engagement lead coordinators who ran the ground game of getting the survey out and back in five different health authorities, and frankly, most significantly, Lena Cuthbertson and her trusty sidekick, Lillian Parsons, who lived and breathed all aspects of this survey night and day for almost 2 years. There was at every turn an outpouring of goodwill that signaled a true desire to understand life in care facilities and the perspective of those who live there, and there was a palpable yearning to make things better. It was simply breathtaking to watch over 800 British Columbians step forward and volunteer to be the person who would sit with residents, often for more than an hour, engage with them, learn their life story, and provide them with the opportunity to tell other British Columbians what it's like to live in residential care. There were retired and active nurses, social workers, lawyers, engineers, teachers, counselors, students, postal workers, medical students, clergy, name a profession or a walk of life, and it was represented in our rich mosaic of volunteers. Together, these men and women undertook intense training. They learned how to ask the question to ensure neutrality, how to assess if the client was able to complete the survey, how to use the analog board, how to use the survey website, register for shifts, record completed interviews, and, of course, the ever-present lecture on hand hygiene. These volunteers walked out of their training sessions, tote bags slung over their shoulder, and they sallied forth to embark on over 25,000 hours of listening to some of the most fascinating British Columbians, those who have lived 80, 90, or 100 years, and who can share with us a wisdom and perspective that only comes with the passage of time. We asked folks to volunteer for 30 hours, but more than half were so drawn to the power of the experience that they volunteered in excess of this, including one volunteer who donated 219 hours of her time. That is the same as working full time for 6 weeks. That's an entire career in the life of a millennial. So they have a voice too, and we're going to hear from them. We're going to listen for a moment to some of their thoughts. And I just a reminder to those who are only listening on the phone that you can find this video on the Seniors Advocate website under the PowerPoint presentation. So let's listen to these volunteers.
I really felt like I was a keeper of a story again, many stories, because as I listened to the people, and yes, they talked about what the questions were that I was asking, but they gave a lot about their life stories, their issues, their concerns, and what concerned them for the future, and I thought, you know, I might be the last person to listen to these stories. It was important to them, and it's important to me.
I lost my own mother about a year ago at the age of 93. And I miss her, but I also miss all the people around her, the other residents that I used to meet and talk with and laugh with when I went to visit her. So this survey gave me a way to reconnect with some of those people.
Not exactly the reason most people did. I'd heard stories about care homes, some of them horror stories, and I'm sort of in the, shall we say, vulnerable bracket of being in one. So I said, well, it's a good chance to go and find out what's going on. So I did.
I just said to her, let's just take a break. And I just sat there and held her hands, and tears rolled down her face. You know, obviously, the question at that time was touching a deep part of her.
It was one I said, I'm not going to ask you to do this because it's too difficult. I want you to explain to me tell me if you have anything else you'd like to say. I said, I know you can't say it. She was wonderful. He said, oh, that's where I was wrong. He signaled that I should, the way I've got to understand each other, that I should sit there. It took about 15 minutes. And he had a machine that he could use with his eyeballs. And he spelled out the story, and he apologized for not being as lucid as he liked to have been, because his wife had died the previous week.
When we completed the survey and I walked her back to the dining room, she was walking along with her walker, and she said, I feel so much smarter now.
I think it was important, is important, because we can look at things as academics and we can look at things as professionals and say this is what people need when they go into a facility. But we're not there, and we don't know it from the story of the people who were living that experience.
I think for me, the residents were just so open to, first of all, being asked, and then secondly, with someone whose job was just to listen. You know, there was no agenda other than to listen to the responses. And so I was amazed at their generosity of being able to share. I think I would call it their grace and their resilience to be able to stay with the questions, but also just to accept that this is where they needed to be, even though it may not be where they wanted to be.
I don't know how often we actually slow down to ask residents how they feel, the choices that they have, if their voice is valued in our process. And I think the survey gives us that voice. It forces us to stop, to slow down, and reflect on the answers that we have, reflect as a collective voice what we've heard. And that's the most important, because if we're not impacting quality of life, why are we here? Why are we a service provider? And really, why do we exist then?
I learned a lot, because they were asking questions, and when you answer the question, then you learn too. So it was interesting.
I just really want to say thank you, because I think that they were so gracious and willing to do this for us. We really owe them everything because of that.
They knew that they were contributing, that they knew that they could, even in this facility, make change for the whole province by what they had to say. I think it did a lot more for people's spirits, confidence, and hope than maybe people anticipated.
I know there are several of the volunteers here today in Vancouver, as well as the satellite events in Victoria, Kelowna, and Prince George. Wherever you are, please stand. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. On behalf of the thousands and thousands of seniors you gave voice to, thank you. We celebrate your commitment, and we draw hope from the fact that so many people are so dedicated to seeing seniors enjoy their last years of life with dignity, comfort, and meaning. Lastly, the inspiration of the residents themselves is perhaps most moving. 10,000 women and men in their 80s, their 90s, and even their 100s, with a variety of aches and pains, took the time, sometimes a lot of time, to share their thoughts and wisdom with us. These surveys were not for the faint of heart. There were 103 questions. I personally did some of the interviews, only about 6 though, and I was exhausted after one interview. What's most touching, however, is not that we should thank the residents. It's that the residents thanked us. You sat down, with every resident who wanted to tell us their story, and you listened. You engaged. You told them their opinion mattered. You met them as equals. And we were rewarded with an outpouring of advice and an incredible, incredible repository of information. The grace and equanimity of these proud and stoic former doctors, judges, teachers, singers, models, housewives, pilots, soldiers, plumbers, truck drivers, professors, politicians, taxi drivers, divas, and bon vivants should humble us all. To these residents, I say, we say, thank you. We appreciate your time. Now, we deliberate, which is to say that we engage in long and careful consideration of what the residents have told us. First, why this survey? This survey is about measuring the quality of care homes from the perspective of the people who live there. You know, we run around and measure any number of indicators. We look at falls and infection rates and staffing levels and complaints and licensing infractions and the use of certain medications. And we equate success in these areas as a signal of high quality. Yes, it's important to monitor these activities. But what about the other aspects of life? Do residents have friends? Are they lonely? How do the staff treat them? Are mealtimes enjoyable? Do they feel a sense of purposefulness? Are they engaged in meaningful activities? How responsive are we to their needs? These are all important aspects of the daily life for residents. How are we measuring success in achieving quality in these areas? We spend over $2 billion a year in BC funding care facilities for the sole purpose of providing the best possible experience for our loved ones. Shouldn't we ask them how we're doing as well as looking at numbers on a chart? Most businesses ask their customers often and directly how they are doing, and the successful ones respond with needed course corrections based on the feedback. We should strive for no less in providing for the most frail and vulnerable in our society. We chose the INTERI Self-Reported Resident Quality of Life Survey for Long-Term Care Facilities, there's a mouthful, and the Family Survey for Long-Term Care through a consultative committee that included everybody. Everybody was there. Frontline staff, care facility operators from the private sector, the public sector, the policymakers were there, the funders were there, the academics were there, the family members. Over 25 people deliberated for almost a year and landed on a survey that's been exhaustively tested, trialed, and used throughout the world. INTERI is the gold standard in the world of long-term care, and the decision to use this tool was made after a rigorous review. Every possible review by BC privacy legislators, health data experts, the list goes on, was undertaken, and I can assure you that this survey is road-tested and our methodology has received approvals from the highest level. Why all care homes? Well, care homes don't exist in a vacuum. If we want to make system-wide improvements that will bring care improvements to all facilities, we need to have consistent system-wide feedback. In BC, the taxpayers fund care homes to the tune of $1.9 billion. The other $500 million-plus comes from the residents themselves. So there is indeed an obligation on the part of government to look at all these care homes and to see if the intended outcome of this investment is being achieved. The magnitude of the total investment we make requires the rigor and oversight on the level undertaken in this survey. Why every resident? Why did we choose to approach all residents? Why not a sample? Why not exclude people who could obviously not answer? Why? Because every voice counts, and everyone has some abilities, and we all have opinions. Just because we need some help to get up in the morning to take a bath or take our medicines does not mean that we have surrendered our right to know what we like and what we don't like. Our right to decide for ourselves if we are enjoying activities and conversations does not end when we find ourselves on the other side of the care home's sliding door as it closes. You know, Stephen Hawking needs help with every aspect of his activities of daily living. He's probably an ADL-6, the highest level of physical impairment. And we would not for a moment think that he is incapable of providing an opinion on whether or not he enjoys his mealtime, never mind an opinion on the origin of the universe. A dementia diagnosis does not terminate one's ability to form meaningful opinions. Dementia is a spectrum, and those who are diagnosed will be at different stages of the journey along that spectrum. Glenn Campbell was still performing before audiences of thousands 2 to 3 years after his diagnosis. I could go on, but I think the point is made. So why this methodology? Any of us who know life and long-term care know that you cannot survey residents with a popular 10-minute phone survey of push one for yes and two for no. These are surveys that must be conducted one-to-one in person if you are really sincere and interested in knowing what people think, especially for a survey as rich as the InterAI Quality of Life Survey. Remember, we're asking people about a variety of aspects of their daily life. We need to ask a lot of questions. So we had two choices. We could pay people or we could ask for volunteers. Regardless, we were going to have to recruit, screen, and train. Bluntly, using volunteers saved over $500,000. But more than that, when you come to the task as a volunteer, you are signaling a willingness to engage in a way that is frankly necessary if we want to get meaningful feedback. In my lifetime, I have been a volunteer, I have worked for volunteers, and I have worked with volunteers. And I believe in the integrity of those who volunteer their time. So while recruiting 800 volunteers was a challenge, I think we can all agree it was worth it. Now, some of the specifics about the survey. We approached just over 22,000 residents in 292 facilities with publicly funded beds. So it might have been a private facility, but it had publicly funded beds, 292 of them. The reason a resident was excluded and wasn't approached is because they had been discharged, they were deceased, they were palliative, or they were a risk to the volunteer. There were probably about 2,700 residents that were excluded using this criteria. 9,603 residents responded, 43% response rate. As I've said, there were a total of 103 questions, and residents spent anywhere from 30 minutes to 2 hours engaged in answering the questions. The family survey, which we technically call the most frequent visitor, or MFV survey, was received by almost 20,000 family members, and we received 9,604 responses to date. Some are still rolling in, and we will continue to update. Overall response rate is 48%. It contained 104 questions. It was sent by postal mail. You could fill it out on the paper and mail it in, or you could go to a secure website and answer it online. We were provided with the names and addresses of the most frequent visitor by the care home operator. So with a 43% response rate, we actually came close to getting the opinions of the majority of residents. The question, the pollsters like to say, is always, did enough people answer the survey that we can confidently infer that their views are representative? Well, the good news is, from a statistically valid perspective, this is an extremely robust response rate, and we can draw great confidence. For example, the professional pollsters in the province will perform a survey of 1,500 people as representing the views of 4 million British Columbians. So I think that tells us, when we look at the 10,000 opinions out of 22,000 people, we can have a great degree of certainty. Through linking the respondents who answered to their individual RAI assessments. Those are the clinical assessments we have for residents. And it was anonymized, so we don't know people's names specifically. We were able to see the relative levels of cognitive and physical function of those who responded to the surveys, those who didn't respond to the surveys, and the overall population. And we were also able to see that for the residents of the most frequent visitors who responded. Now, this is a background note. I'm going to throw some terms and numbers out here. I'm going to use two terms, CPS, Cognitive Performance Scale. This measures a person's cognitive ability. It goes from 0, which is no impairment, to 6, high level of impairment, likely somebody who is non-responsive or in a coma. The other term I'm going to use is ADL, Activities of Daily Living. Again, it's a scale of 0 to 6, and it measures physical impairment. So 0, no physical impairment at all. 6, severe physical impairment, likely requiring total assistance for all activities of daily living. So we found overall that 90% of the respondents to this survey had a CPS score of 3 or less, compared to 70% of the overall population. So the people who responded were more cognitively aware to some extent than the people who did not answer. 72% of respondents had an ADL score of 3 or less compared to 60% of the overall population. So we heard from the, on average, to a higher degree, from the slightly more physically able people. But when we looked at the responses from the most frequent visitors, it absolutely mirrored the population. We had to check it a couple of times because it was bang on. 70% CPS 3 or less and 60% ADL or less. So we're getting a fairly good representative sample of the overall population here. And here's something that was interesting to look at. One of the brush-offs that we will give to complaints about residential care is that we will fault the residents on their memory. You know, they did have a bath, they just don't remember. We've got activities on the weekend, they just don't remember. Well, when we looked at the answers of people relative to their CPS score, there was almost no change as CPS scores rose. So the answers from those with no cognitive impairment were almost identical to the answers from those who had a CPS 3, which is moderate impairment, or 4, which is an even higher degree of impairment. You've got to think about this. One of the things seniors fear the most, all seniors, whether they're in a care facility or a Shaughnessy mansion, they're worried that the veracity of their recall is going to be questioned just because of their age. When the 35-year-old says, no, I didn't take that money, you must be mistaken. And the 90-year-old says, no, I'm sure I had a $50 bill in my wallet. Let's all of us be really honest about who we're most likely to believe most of the time. Well, these results should shame us all a little bit, because the evidence is pretty clear that it looks like age and physical impairment do not necessarily equal memory loss, and even some cognitive impairment does not appear to materially affect a person's ability to express an informed opinion on their daily life experiences. So, just a little bit of context about what the residents were telling us. So first of all, they generally view themselves as happier than most. 67% say they're happier than most other people all or most of the time. And only 11% said they're rarely or never happier than most other people. Half of the residents rated the overall quality of their care home as excellent or very good. Now half didn't, but half did. One out of four doesn't want to be there, but 77% would recommend it to another person. Just over half of residents, 57%, think their facility regularly feels like home. And their assessment of their own health was interesting. So overall, 39% think their health is pretty good, 27% think it's very good, and 9% think they're in excellent health. 59% saw themselves as having some limitations in bathing and or dressing. 63% reported they felt downhearted at some point in the last week. And we asked them to compare their health now to what it was a year ago. Just over half, 54%, said their health is about the same. 13% said it's better, and 10% said it's much better. It can improve. So the context for this survey and its answers is that for the most part it expresses the opinions of people who view themselves as relatively happy and healthy, but with some limitations. So, let's start with what's working well. And to be clear, some things are working well. For the most part, residents feel safe. 88% feel they're safe in the care home, and 77% feel their possessions are safe. They think the staff are competent and that they treat the residents with respect. 83% believe the staff are competent. They know what they're doing, and they're treating them with respect. 80% say they can decide for themselves what they're going to wear and how they're going to spend their time each day. And 80% say they're getting the services that they meet. 9 out of 10, 90%, say their families are made to feel welcome whenever they want to visit, and both the residents and the family report that they can find a place that's private and appropriate to meet with their loved one when they do visit. The families, there's some good news here too. 88% of families report they feel involved in decisions about their loved one. Almost 90%, 89%, know who to talk to for information. 88% feel that the staff actually address their concerns. 93% say the home is clean. And 82% say it smells good. And 88% of family members who've witnessed aggressive behavior on residents actually thought that the staff handled the situation appropriately. So that's good. That's good to know. It's a safe place. It's a welcoming place. And people are feeling comfortable. But we also learned that there are areas where we can improve. Bathing, toileting, physical discomfort. One of the single biggest complaints from well over half the residents, 62%, don't get to bathe or shower as often as they want. In fact, a full 50% say they rarely or never get to bathe or shower as often as they want. We know that the current minimum standard is one bath or shower a week, and I think it's pretty clear that a majority of residents don't think this is enough. We can't dismiss this with they were raised on the farm and they only bathed once a week when they were growing up. That's not what they're telling us. And I just ask all of you and everyone listening to think about how you would feel if you were only able to bathe or shower once a week. And by the way, we'll tell you what day and what time. A full 25% of residents report they don't reliably get help as quickly as they need to go to the toilet. 40% of our residents are continent. They are able to go to the toilet. They have sufficient bladder control and awareness that they need to know. They know when they need to go. But they need some help getting there. And for these people, more than a quarter of the time, we're not reliably there for them. 1 out of 4 residents is waiting too long, if not indefinitely, for relief of physical discomfort. So this isn't pain, this is physical discomfort. So most of us can shift our bodies in the chair, get up and stretch and walk around, or reach for the bottle of Tylenol when we're feeling a little achy or stiff. But think about what it would be like if you need that pillow move to stop the jabbing, but you can't do it yourself. You need to call somebody to help. And you wait. And you wait. And you wait. Improving mealtimes. Poor food is one of the most pervasive negative images many in the public have with regard to nursing homes, frankly, hospitals, airlines, not just nursing homes. In fact, 67% of residents reported they actually enjoy their mealtime. That does leave a third not enjoying it. But the main beef is not so much about what they're eating, but when they're eating it. Over half of the residents, 52%, report they don't reliably get to eat when they want. We can improve the variety. 41% say there's not enough. The temperature isn't right for about a third. But I think many, including myself, frankly, saw these areas getting higher marks than expected, and I didn't expect the single biggest complaint to be about the timing. I also didn't expect 38% of people who need help with eating to report they don't reliably get it. So apparently we need to rethink the rigidity of our mealtime schedule. And if we think about ourselves in a care home, it begins to make sense. Almost all care homes, breakfast over and done by 9, lunch over by 1, dinner all wrapped up by 6, usually the last stragglers are leaving at 5:30. We talk about flexibility. We talk about, oh, we have flexible meal plans, oh, you know, we have snacks. We're not delivering the flexibility we think we are. We are trying, but we're not achieving the outcome we're aiming for. Not all people over the age of 85 start their dinners at 4:30 or 5. Some people have been late risers all their life, and they want breakfast to begin at 9, not end. Making life more meaningful. We hear a lot from seniors about how they feel devalued, ignored, invisible, and talked about rather than to. Well, apparently this doesn't change if one moves into a care home. There are a number of the survey questions that probe issues of belonging and meaning and engagement. Having staff who have friendly conversations and know their life story, having a close friend, someone with whom to share things in common and do things with, being asked for advice or help, engaging in activities that have meaning. In these areas, we actually saw some of the lowest overall scores in the survey. We really need to step back and take stock of what many residents are telling us. We promote residential care as an antidote to the loneliness and isolation of living at home alone, and we speak about the increased social engagement. However, we're missing the mark in this area for many of the residents. The majority of residents are not regularly finding it easy to make friends. They don't have like-minded people that they can do things with. However, they do think the other residents treat them with respect. I think most of us expected to see low scores for activities on weekends and evenings. We know we struggle there. But the activities we offer during the week are not as meaningful as they should be. Just over a third, 36%, report they regularly participate in activities that are meaningful. When we look at these scores, we look at the resident assessment, and I believe we have some strong evidence to support a rethink of our catch-all complex care designation. Mea culpa, I was around when we blended intermediate, and some of you in the room were probably there then too, when we blended intermediate care with extended care. I remember the arguments about the seamless progression as care needs increased, there was no move required. But I'm actually not sure that we analyzed the data enough to see just how often did we actually move residents from intermediate care to extended care. We might have found an interesting answer. Assisted living was just in its infancy at that time, and we may not have recognized its full potential. As well, the ability of home care to be stepped up was missing from that conversation. The overriding theme at that time was efficiency. 20 years on, it might be a good time to reassess. The residents who answered this survey are the most engaged and cognitively competent, and they're 43% of the population. We are very successful in providing them an environment that is safe and secure, but we are failing them in providing an environment where they feel engaged and purposeful. Only 33% report they have a fellow resident as a close friend all or most of the time. 27% say they rarely or never get to spend time with like-minded residents. Half of them struggle to make friends. 45% say they rarely or never have people to do things with. And 40% say they rarely or never get to explore new skills and interests. Make more time for the little things. So building on the themes of creating more meaningful experiences is making more time for the little things. Again, staff get very high marks for their competence and the respectful way they treat residents, but we're failing in providing those little things that can add meaning to our day. Think about the workplace, our workplace, where for many people the highlight of the day is the five-minute conversation around the coffee pot or the chat while queuing at the printer. We get to know an amazing amount about people we work with from these little snippets of conversation that later allow us to ask how someone's daughter did at her soccer tournament or how the cousin's weekend wedding went. Well, it's no different for residents in care homes. We don't lose our desire for connection with people around us as we age. Care staff are like those coworkers we saw every day, and fellow residents are like our extended family. However, the majority of residents, 55%, are telling us that staff does not regularly make time for a friendly conversation, and just over half, 58%, can reliably consider a staff member their friend. Interestingly enough, when we look at the Translating Research in Elder Care, TREC, survey results of care aides in 31 facilities in BC, we find they also report they're not engaging in conversations with residents as much as they would like. They're checking off the list of all the care activities, the services, and by the time they come to the end of that list, And sometimes even before they come to the end of that list, their shift is over. This observation is supported by the 33% of residents that report staff really doesn't have enough time. And by the way, in their totality, all of these observations are echoed by the family members. We have to realize that relationships are built on familiarity. You establish a bond with someone over time as you discover more and more areas of common interest and experience. And we are frustrating this to a large extent with revolving staff. Pretty much half, 49% of the respondents, don't routinely see the same carriers during the week. This is making the relationship development that is necessary for engagement more challenging. 24% of residents don't tell staff when they're not happy about something, yet only 11% feel they can't voice their opinion. So it's not because they don't want to. It's not because they fear reprisal. There's nobody there to hear them. Improve the relationship with the primary care provider, the doctor. Only 43% of residents report that their doctor visits them when they're sick, and only 44% rate their physician care as very good or excellent. 42% say they don't know what medications they're on, and 38% say they weren't consulted. This is an area where the solution will likely require a significant overhaul in the way we deliver primary care to residential care facilities. Physicians in this province are in short supply and overextended. Now, the evidence is overwhelming that the clinical results are better in care homes with consistent physician care. One facility, one doctor. Now, we're currently muddling around out there in a whole bunch of different pilot projects all over the province, and we've empowered little groups of physicians here and there to come up with their own solution on how to do it, and it's all being rejigged. Another way to describe that would be we're running madly off in all directions. When we look at the future, I think we really need to ask why a nurse practitioner cannot become the de facto physician for a residential care facility. We're nibbling at the edges of this. We're rationalizing a whole lot of reasons why we won't fully commit to that. But when we see these results, the overarching question I have is, what do we have to lose? We are satisfying less than half the residential care population with the current model. Why not try a new one? So, these are just some of the highlights of this rich, robust survey you've all been given copies of. There were 103 questions. I encourage you all to read through to see the results, and you will form different opinions on whether results are good or bad, frankly, depending on your perspective and your experiences. But I tried to give you a little flavor of what's in that survey. And if I had to sum up what the 20,000 voices, 10,000 residents, 10,000 family members are telling us, we need more staff. We need to give residents more freedom, and we need to have more conversations. So where do we go from here? The report provides eight recommendations. The first one, increase staffing. A large number of areas, whether it's frequency of bathing, getting to toilet on time, having someone at meal times, having the conversation. The overarching or common thread, I should say, that's running through all of those, there are not enough staff. We know in British Columbia that over 80% of our facilities are not staffed at the recommended level. We need to get there, and we need to get there as quickly as possible. Even with the staffing levels, what they need to be, however, we need to increase the flexibility around when and how care services and activities are delivered. There is a message. They don't get to eat when they want. They don't get to get up when they want. They don't get to spontaneously do things when they want. We're going to have to come to terms with how we are going to create an environment that allows the flexibility and freedom for those who are still capable of exercising it, and many are. We need to provide better physician care, and I think we need to explore the role of the nurse practitioner. Physician care is significant. They're deciding what medications they're on, whether or not they're getting treated, whether or not they're getting transferred to the hospital. It has a big impact on the quality of life, and frankly, it has a big impact on overall utilization in the healthcare system. We need to look at opportunities to improve mealtime. Now, any reasonable person is going to know that when you're trying to provide meals three times a day to 50, 100, 200, 300 people, everybody is not going to be happy all the time. But I think we have seen we can make some improvements by giving some flexibility around timing, by increasing the variety, and by making sure it's at the right temperature. Providing education for care staff on the importance of emotional well-being in supporting quality of care. So yes, we need more staff, but we also need to make sure that in addition to the technical training, which we appear to be doing a very good job of, we need to make sure that care aides understand the importance of that emotional connection, that they need to take the time to have the conversation and to understand. We need to foster greater engagement between families and care homes on promoting family councils and hand hygiene. So one of the good things is care homes are getting a fairly high mark from families around engagement. There's just two areas where we need to look for improvement, and these should be straightforward. 24% of family members reported they knew nothing about a family council. So we need to do a better job of informing families about family councils. And if there isn't one in the facility where their loved one is, we need to encourage them to create one. And also, we're not doing as good a job as we could in promoting hand hygiene. Only 9% of family members are reporting that they're being told about hand hygiene and shown proper hand hygiene. The evidence is very clear that reducing infection rates, the single biggest thing we can do is increase hand hygiene. And so I have chosen to focus on that as one of the areas for improvement. And the eighth recommendation is to monitor the progress on this by requiring health authorities to have facilities administer this survey in 2 years, 2019-20, and my office will follow with another province-wide survey in 2021-2022. Isn't going to do any good to measure our progress if we go running off madly in all directions and everybody does their own survey and they start changing the questions and they start. It's not a perfect survey. No survey will be. Although, interestingly, you often find when survey results tell people what they want to hear, it's a great survey. When survey results tell them what they don't want to hear, it's a bad survey. All I can tell you is, as I told you earlier, this is the gold standard. And we really have to use the same survey, the same methodology. We can uncomplicate it a bit and give it back to the facilities to ensure that their facility is surveyed. But we really do have to use the same instrument, or we're going to be comparing apples and oranges, and we're not going to know whether or not we have made progress. So it's important to recognize there are many things that are working in our care facilities, and there are some residents who appear fairly satisfied. However, it's clear not all residents are satisfied, and there are some that are deeply dissatisfied. The opinions of care residents are as varied as the opinions of neighbors living on any street. Everyone will not be happy all the time, in part because standards and expectations are different. But I think that most of us will agree that the results of this survey point to some fairly urgent needs that should be addressed. Longer term, maybe some improvements can be found in doing a better job of matching people based on common interests. They're more likely to have similar expectations, which will make it easier to satisfy a group of people in a communal setting. The vast majority of everyone sitting in this room, listening to this webcast, on the phone, will never live in a care facility. The majority of BC seniors, even the vast majority of those over 85, are enjoying and will continue to enjoy the rest of their life in their own home. They'll have some aches and pains of growing older, but they will be in relative comfort and happiness. This report does not speak to the experience or paint the image of all seniors by any means, but it does speak to the experience of the frailest among us. Only 4% of seniors are in care facilities, and even at age 85 plus, only 15% live in a care facility. But here's the thing. You can't predict today where you're going to be tomorrow. You can eat all the broccoli in the world. You can never sit down all day. You can festoon the house with grab bars, and you can sip only herbal tea as you puzzle through your daily Sudoku. And you still may be in residential care. Today, it might be your grandmother. Tomorrow, your mother or your spouse. And maybe someday, yourself. So how do you want to live? What do you value? Let's look at these results through that lens, and I think most of us will conclude we can do better. I thank you for taking time from what I know are very busy schedules and, as I say, a beautiful day outside. It is heartwarming that so many are committed to this issue, and I cannot thank enough the volunteers, the residents, and the family members who gave so generously of their time to give us this rich, rich, rich repository of information. My office will continue to further analyze data, and we're likely going to publish future reports on specific aspects of the survey. But I'm now going to turn this over to Lena to moderate the question period, and I am pleased to take any of your questions. Over to you, Lena.
Thank you, Isabel. So we now have approximately 45 minutes for questions, and we want to give the opportunity for questions to rotate between the locations in Vancouver, Kelowna, Victoria, and Prince George, as well as an opportunity for questions that come in through the webinar. If you have a question here in Vancouver, I'll ask you to please go up to the microphones now. I do want to let you know that I am receiving questions from the satellite locations and from the web chat via my mobile device. So I want to apologize in advance if I'm looking at my mobile device and let you know that I am fully focused. Knowing that there are media in the room who are on tight deadlines, I've been asked to take the questions from media first, and then to take questions from the satellite locations via the web chat. And due to call volume, those of you who are joining us by phone will not have an opportunity to ask questions during this event. However, any and all questions, including questions which we don't get to during the course of the next 45 minutes, can be directed to the Office of the Seniors Advocate's general email address at info@seniorsadvocatebc.ca and will be answered by the Office of the Seniors Advocate staff following the event. So I want to start by taking a couple of questions first from the media who are present here in Vancouver. Can I ask any representative of the media to please identify themselves at the microphone?
Okay, Tracy. I'm Marcella Bernardo from News 1130. I was hoping to ask you what you meant when you said that there was a palpable yearning for people to make a difference.
Isabel, could you repeat the question? I don't think it.
I think the question was, what did I mean when I said there was a palpable yearning to make a difference and to see improvements? It was in the response to the call for volunteers. It was in the response to requests for funding. It was in response to family members. Every step along the way, there wasn't a moment's hesitation. We need to do this. We need to make sure we're getting this right.
Just a quick follow-up. How much of this all comes down to the adage, respect your elders?
Probably about half of it. I think that half of these issues are about we don't have enough staff in our care facilities. And I think this is a good tool to tell us when we get that additional staff where we should be focusing our time. But that's not all of it. I think that there is, weaving through this, a issue around not respecting the ability, particularly the cognitive ability, of seniors in our care facilities. And just because you're a little slow to give an answer doesn't mean the answer doesn't have as much impact.
Okay, I'll take one more question from Vancouver before moving to our satellite location.
Hello, my name is Ross McKellett, and as a teenager, I worked as a nurse aide at Vancouver General Hospital, and I did the graveyard shift. And one of some of the most profound moments in my life was speaking to elderly men or women who couldn't sleep, and about 2 or 3 in the morning, they wanted to tell their story. So I'm impressed with the survey results at getting at the fact that many elderly people, now this was in a hospital setting, but the same sort of situation, wanting to share things. But one of your recommendations, we need more staff, so it looks like a whole new way of thinking of things, that maybe the middle of the night is when some people want to do meaningful activities. So my question is for comment on that, and also, are there other countries in the world who are doing it better than we're doing it here in BC?
So the first part of your question, yes, I agree that in addition to more staff, it is more flexibility. In part, that's posing the question around complex care as the only designation for all people. There are different people in care facilities, and I think that part of the challenge is we've lumped everybody together and we're treating them all the same. So that's number one. Number two, are there countries that are doing it better? It depends. So there are things we do well. For example, the universality of residential care. The good news is, every British Columbian, regardless of their ability to pay, is entitled to get a subsidized residential care bed. That doesn't exist in all countries. Other countries do a better job of keeping people at home longer, and so those voices you hear from the people who feel they're not engaged and they don't have, they would actually still be at home in the community and active. I think that there are some models of care in Europe where populations are better grouped so that you do have greater similarity amongst the residents.
I'm now going to just pause to say that here in the Vancouver location, if you are unable to make your way to the microphone, please raise your hand as we do have a roving microphone. I'm now going to move to a question, Isabel, from Kelowna. And the question is, as a member of the public, what can I do to help keep our community and the government accountable to these results?
It's a good question. I think that everybody has a commitment to make it better, to make it as good as possible. I think governments, regardless,
of which side of the house they sit on, want to see things better. But sometimes things are very slow to move forward. And I think what we can do, and certainly what my office will be doing, is continuing to monitor the commitment that has been made around increasing the staffing. There's a commitment to add 3 million additional hours to our care facilities. And so we need to make sure and be vigilant that that is happening. And I think the other thing we can do is just to continue as citizens, as we engage with older people and as we engage with other people about older people, is to reinforce everybody's not the same. Most people have abilities. Everybody has opinions.
I have a follow-up question to the one that you've just responded to from Victoria, and it's a two-part question. Have you had any response from government to this report, and what do you hope the response from government will be? So have you had any response from government? What do you hope the response will be?
This report has just been released, so I haven't received official response from government. My expectation is it will be supportive. Government funded this survey. And my expectation is that we will see a continued commitment to increase care staffing. We may see an acceleration of how quickly staffing levels are increased. I think we could look there. And I think that there's going to be a discussion within the care community about these results and how we can improve things. And I do hope that there is support for measuring progress in 2 years' time.
Okay. I have a series of questions. The questions are coming in fast and furious from Prince George. And two of the questions are on the same vein. Are there reports and were there differences between health regions or geographic locations and between public and private facilities? So are there reports and were there differences between health regions or geographic locations between public and private facilities?
Okay. So posted on the website concomitant with the release of this report was a breakdown of the results health authority by health authority. So you can go and see for every question how did they answer it in Coastal, Fraser, Northern, Interior, and DHOP. Overall, for the most part, actually pretty consistently, we did not see variation amongst health authorities of any statistical significance. It's fairly consistent across the board. In terms of further, we will be doing further analysis and drill down on the results in the year ahead. In terms of the differences between public and private, we did look overall at quality levels. Were they, you know, the overall quality better or worse in one or the other? And actually, there is no difference. So whether you're in a publicly run and publicly funded care bed or privately run and publicly funded care bed, really the results mirror one another.
Okay, I'm going to offer you a question now that came in through the web chat. Would the seniors advocate receive finances to put towards the shortcoming that the survey results put forward? Which office would be responsible to overlook the implementation of the survey results?
Lena, I didn't hear just the first part of that question.
Would the seniors advocate's office receive finances to put towards the shortcoming that the survey has put forward, survey results?
Okay.
The short answer is
the money shouldn't come to me. The money needs to get out to the care homes to hire the staff and make things better. So I don't need more money, but the care homes do. And in terms of oversight, that is a function of my job or of this office. And so we will be posting when the facility level results are released, which will be later this year. They will be posted on the directory of care facilities, and we would be monitoring, my hope is, results in 2 years and definitely 4 years from now to see if there's been any progress.
Okay. Before I go back to the microphone here in Vancouver, I'm going to ask by a show of hands if there's anyone who's unable to get to the microphone that would like a roving mic brought to them. If you would, could you just wave so that I can see you? Okay, since I don't see anyone, I'm going to go back to the microphone here in Vancouver. Could we have the next question, please?
Hi, thank you for being here. I really appreciate your presentation. My name is Chris Morrissey, and my partner and I would have participated in your survey, and certainly the recommendations bear out my experience of being in residential care with my partner. One of the things that clearly what you're looking at here in the outcomes are very general and cover a whole bunch of varieties, and I'm wondering whether you have data that you can break out to look at the various diversities that exist among people who are in residential care. My partner and I, we're lesbians, and I'm wondering, given the fact that we also age and are in need of residential care, if you have data that looks into those more diverse and specific concerns of residents like ourselves.
So to answer your question, we tried in this survey, and I think we are going to be analyzing the results. So how we tried was that we asked residents to identify if they were gay or lesbian. We can take those answers, and we can see what the responses were for all the other questions based on that, but we haven't done that analysis yet, and I have to be frank with you and say that my expectation is it's going to produce a small sample from which we can't be confident of the statistical validity of the answers. It is an area that I think we do need to pay more attention to, but it's difficult to get some data from existing residents in care homes.
Mm-hmm. And there are structural reasons for that.
Yes.
So I will, in fact, be in touch with your office to begin a conversation around those issues.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you, Chris.
So, Isabel, I'm now going to give you a question from Kelowna that came up before, but I'm not sure that you were able to answer it. Was there a significant difference in response between public and private facilities? So I wonder if it might be helpful to say a few words about contracted versus public-private.
Thank you. So we did separate the results by public and private, and overall, not a statistically significant difference between the two. And we specifically, you can go through and, you know, you might find a little tick up on this question, a little tick down, but when you look overall at the totality of it, there really is no difference.
Okay. So I'm now going to give you a question from the chat room. What role can city or local government play to help ensure city planning considers the impact of their decisions on the quality of life for seniors' care?
Well, I think what local governments can do, they have limited tools available to them, but they do have the ability to zone. They have the ability, some, through parks and recreation, to have outreach into facilities. The strongest thing I think that can be done is for local government to recognize and appreciate, for certainly a good portion of residents in our care facilities, being in a facility where there's things around them rather than in the middle of a field is actually of great value. And we've got to look at ways of facilitating that to a better degree, I would say. And that's something that local governments can do. They can also, in the population that's not in residential care, but potentially, is just to ensure that they have robust programs and services, not just for the active senior, the 65-year-old on the tennis court, but that there are services for seniors as they become more frail and are still living in the community.
Okay. I have a question from Victoria. 85% of seniors live at home. Will you survey at-home seniors to see how they are doing?
We are surveying, we did survey our home support seniors, so the seniors who are living at home in receipt of home support, and we released that report about a year ago to ask how the home support services were meeting their needs, and they had some feedback on that. And we are later this year releasing a report on home support that will provide further insights and recommendations to government on how we can assist the population of seniors that are living at home or in the community that need some help.
Okay. So I'm now going to go back to the microphone here in Vancouver.
Hi. My name is Barb Kirby, and I'm an elder care, later life planner, advocate, navigator, privately. And I am interested in your discussion on family councils. I ran a family council in my dad's care home for 15 years, and it was a successful family council, and the executive was very supportive. It resulted in good things happening in the care home. And then I chaired Advocates for Care Reform. I was on their board for a number of years, and they taught how to run family councils. And it was a sad day when they ran out of money and closed down. But I would love to see, I'd like to know how you are going to support the development of family councils in Vancouver. I know we have one on Vancouver Island, but I'd like to see it throughout the province. And how would you provide support in that area?
So, Barb, thanks for the question. And the family council results are on page 40 of the report. So the first thing we need to do is we need to make sure that every family member is aware of what a family council is and what it can do, number one. Number two, if there is a family council in that facility, we need to make sure they're connected to it, and we need to make sure that that family council gets a lot of support from the care facility to move forward with their work. 26% not aware of a family council. Those who are aware, 38% never attend. So we have to respect that some people are not going to necessarily engage. There is a question about what role regulations could play in requiring facilities to have a family council. The problem is a family council requires family members to come together and volunteer, and it is possible that nobody wants to do it. I think that's unusual, but it is possible. And so how do you weave that into the regulations? And those are discussions we're having with Kim Slater and his group over at Vancouver Island about how to do that. And then I think what you're talking about is how do we have a provincial body or network for family council representatives, right, to gather the way we ought to. That is a very good question. That is something that government may decide it wants to support, but again, it requires representatives from all the organization that has to happen amongst the family councils for that to occur.
Right. And I just have one other comment about the survey. I know you surveyed people who were pretty high functioning overall, but I feel that there are a lot of the vulnerable people who can't speak up are actually the ones who are being abused or neglected, and they don't have a voice. And I wonder how can we open up, how can we get that information? You know, sometimes actually family councils might be able to help in that area, but how can we gather that information, because it's real and it is happening?
Yeah. So what we did, that is one of the reasons why we surveyed the family members, the most frequent visitor, Barb. So they're not a proxy. They're not speaking for the residents, but they are speaking about their own observations about the care delivered to their loved one. And we are going to be further analyzing the data. We know that we heard from family members of profoundly cognitively impaired and disabled residents. And we're going to look at their answers, and we're going to compare. And that will be the subject of future reports that come out.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
I have a question, Isabel, that comes from Prince George, and it's asking, will there be an opportunity for additional community meetings or additional sessions for those unable to attend in additional communities than what we're offered today?
Well, that's a very good question, and frankly, something I didn't think about. And I think that's an idea that we need to look at and see. Certainly, if there is a demand for it, if people want that, I think that my office could respond to that.
Okay. I've got another question from Kelowna. That was the north. Here's the question from Kelowna. The demand for more residential care will likely increase as baby boomers age. Is there planning and discussion about increasing beds and decreasing wait times?
So there's no doubt we are going to need more care beds. I think we will likely see some decrease in the percentage of people that go to residential care as home care becomes more robust, but the absolute numbers are going to increase. And there are planning discussions at the ministry level, at the health authority level, that are looking at those projections. But I think what's really important is we can't have our focus on care for tomorrow at the expense of quality of care today. We need to make sure that the care facilities we do have are offering the excellent level of care and will serve as the standard that will be offered in the care facilities that are to be built as we move forward.
Thank you. Okay, this question comes from Victoria. It's a comment and then a question. We need more skilled workers who have empathy. How or when do you think this will happen?
Well, the Courage commitment is that started in March of 2017 was a four-year plan, and over those 4 years, we would see an additional injection of 3 million hours of care into our care facilities. Those would be with trained workers. Now, I think that most, frankly, not all, I think we have to be honest here, but most people who come into the profession of providing care for seniors do have empathy. And I think that we can look at additional training. But I think the other thing we have to allow for is that many of our care aides today do want to have a conversation, do want to get to know the life story, they just don't have time. And so we need to see how much we're going to be able to raise the bar once we get that injection of necessary additional staffing.
Right. Okay, I'm going to take one more question from the web chat before I move back here to Vancouver. Did the recommendations address the issue of bathing frequency and help with going to the toilet, specifically changing these and other standards? So you spoke about the standard of bath one time per week. So did the recommendations address the issue of bathing frequency and help with going to the toilet, specifically changing these and other standards?
So, and I just want to clarify, you know, the once a week is actually not in any regulation or policy. The regulations and policies are very vague statements that basically say as needed. And so as needed could be when I want when it comes to bathing. Now, I'm going to take a pretty hard line on the toileting, and I'm going to say the standard is if you're continent and you're able to go to the toilet, we should be there to help you, full stop. So that's going to lead to questions about what staffing levels are going to be necessary to meet those outcomes. But I think we've got a long, certainly on the bathing, we've got a long way to travel between once a week and frequency that might be too much. So the question is, can they bathe twice a day? Okay, well, what if you have... But I think common sense has to prevail, and I think most people don't want to bathe two or three times a day. So I think we're going to have to take a look at that.
Great. Okay. Back to the microphone. here in Vancouver.
Hi there, my name is Mary, and I was a volunteer for the survey. And my question is, what can we do to help people who are 60 and 65 years old, and because of a medical condition such as multiple sclerosis, they find themselves in a care facility with people who are in their 80s and 90s, and they feel quite lonely, and they feel like there really weren't any options for housing and to be cared for. So what can we do to help people that age?
Well, I mean, you see that in the survey, right? You see that reflected in there's not like-minded people. There isn't somebody I can do things with. We actually found slightly, ever so slightly lower levels of ratings on people who had the highest cognitive awareness, right? So it's exactly the group you're speaking of. This goes to the heart of the complex care designation, right? I think we need to look more at creating population groups of people who have things in common, and this includes I am aware of everything. I can engage in political discussions. I read the newspaper every day. I just am in a wheelchair and can't live in my own place any longer. We need to ensure that folks like that have other people that they can engage in meaningful conversations with, and that's what got lost when we created this catch-all designation.
Can I just ask, is another question then, is there some way they can have a section of the care home where people are younger or something like that, a recommendation going forward?
Some care homes do that. They have a large enough population, so they might have 25 or 30 what we would call young disabled folks, and so they can create a community. The challenge comes in the smaller facilities where there's only, you know, three or four people like that. It's a real challenge in the rural areas where we have care homes. And so I think part of the question has to be, what part of this do we address with the care home, and what part of this do we address by increasing community support so that these people could be at home?
The next question.
Hello. Thank you for all your hard work, Isabel. And
I didn't do it.
Gwendolyn DeGeest, I represent the Elder Care Foundation from Victoria. Am I talking in this right or wrong?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not used to your microphone. I represent the Elder Care Foundation from Victoria, and I was particularly encouraged by the section of the survey dealing with meaningful activities for our seniors, and I think my question today is more of a visionary question. I'm wondering, Isabel, do you see an impact from the results of your survey that may lead to creating the dementia-friendly community for the seniors in British Columbia?
So to answer your question, I hope, whether it's folks with dementia, and let's remember different stages of dementia, right, find that they are able to live with people with whom they have things in common.
Yes.
So whether it's dementia challenges, whether it's, as the speaker before you, the physical challenges, whether it's linguistic challenges, whether it's the gay community, that people are able to live with other people with whom they feel they have things in common. Because what's coming out of this survey is a lot of people aren't feeling that.
Absolutely, and it's all about inclusion. And oftentimes the person with dementia does not have a voice, and they do feel excluded in the group that they're living with. So
yep, it could be, it can be dementia, it can be hearing impairment, it can be vision impairment, it can be a lot of things.
Thank you very much.
I'm now going to move to the roving mic. We have a question here.
I'm Barb from Burnaby, BC. I was just wondering if for people that are mentally handicapped or just other disabilities, that are seniors, were looked at or something like this survey, that people can look at, to be able to be a part of?
So you're talking about the population of people who have what we would call developmental disabilities, who have lived perhaps in group homes for most of their life, who now find themselves as seniors, if I understand.
Or institutions.
So some of those folks might move into residential care when their needs increase. Those who are not in care and are living in their care homes, that's a very good question to ask of whether, I know there is an advocate for those folks, and whether they want to look at going to those folks and asking about their experiences as well. And I think that one of the challenges we all know is happening is that groups of people are becoming seniors that 30 or 40 years ago didn't live to become seniors, to be blunt about it. And how are we going to deal with those issues? And you've identified a community that I think we don't have the answer for yet, but we know we need to come up with one.
Because a lot of people lived in institutions in the past, and I think nursing homes are just as bad sometimes for people to move from one to another, so they might not want to move to a residential.
Yes. Yeah, no, you've raised a very good, there are a lot of populations, marginalized populations, that we do need to hear from in addition to those in care facilities. I agree.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barb.
Before I take the next question from Vancouver, I just want to take a moment to ask Glenda if she could please wave and say hello, because I want all the volunteers in the room to see Glenda, who starred in the How to Conduct a Structured Interview video. And please take a moment to say hello to her, because Glenda, every one of those 800 volunteers who conducted interviews in British Columbia saw your video, and this was Glenda's acting debut. Glenda is a senior living in the community. So thank you, Glenda. Okay, I'd like now to take another question from Vancouver.
Thank you. I'm Pat Semenek. I was a volunteer surveyor. Thank you very much for the report. A question I have related to, you said that 80% of the homes or the facilities do not have the recommended staffing. Did you see a difference in the results for those 20% that did have the recommended staffing?
It's actually, Pat, it's less than 20% have the recommended staffing. It's 80, I think about 15%. We are going to be doing further analysis to see what the results show on that. But part of the challenge is, you know, there might be very subtle differences just because you're below the bar of 3.36. So, but we are going to do some further analysis on that. But the other thing is to look at the overall population. So a care home may have lower staff, but they also have a population that is lower needs than a facility with higher staff. So,
thank you.
So this is a question, Isabel, from the chat room that I think follows nicely from Pat's question. It says, Isabel continues to state that more staff need to be hired. With a large number of health professionals exiting the profession through retirement and other job opportunities, what is the action to incite and excite high school and middle school students to consider careers working in healthcare and with seniors?
Free training. So if we need to recruit a number of care aides, we know that, although I think we can increase some of the care provided by moving part-time workers to full-time workers, but we are going to need some new care aides. And it takes about 9 months to train. And it costs about $10,000. And so we're putting up a lot of obstacles. And so one of the questions is, and the government will have to answer this, whether there are targeted areas where, in fact, in order to deal with the recruitment challenges, they want to give incentives such as we will pay the cost of your training if you complete your training. We will do, there's a whole variety of ways, and we have historically done it over in different periods of time when different professions have been in short supply. But that might be one way that we can accelerate getting these 3 million care hours into our facilities.
Great. Okay, back to Vancouver.
Hi, I'm Nicholas. I'm a social worker at Fleetwood Place. And I have a couple of questions. One is whether ethics was considered when asking some of the questions about forming a special relationship with a staff member or a resident that considered a staff member a friend. That's discouraged in some facilities, including ours, so I'm wondering if that was analyzed. And then one other question about the scoring. We were wondering why good was put in the same category as poor, why that decision was made.
Okay, so I could let Lena answer the ethics question. I don't know that you want that. I can assure you it was tested, and we can give you a very robust technical answer on that. And then your second question was
scoring.
The scoring. I think you are confusing what was sent to facilities with this report. So what you will find is sometimes is not categorically negative. So we have, when the report, first of all, you can see all the numbers in the report, number one. Number two, the top two always and most
very,
of the
time. It was excellent and very good.
Or always and most of the time, right? But
and
it, everything,
the was poor,
that's correct.
And, yeah.
Everything was on a 5-point scale. The top two were lumped as positive. So when I say 88% feel or 90% feel, it means the answers are in the top two boxes added together, okay? When we say rarely or never, we mean rarely or never. When we say not reliably, we're meaning the sometimes. So if you're only sometimes being helped to the toilet, you're not reliably being helped to the toilet, as opposed to saying you're never being helped. And so that's the way the language of this report and this presentation. I think you've seen your facilities results online, and that's a very different way of presenting the results.
Well, one of the questions about the facility was whether the quality of the facility and very good and excellent was one part, and then but the second part, the bottom percentile, was good but also poor. So when recommending the facility, 50% said they recommended it, but 50% said they didn't, but that included people that said it was not or poor as well as...
And that's why we have chosen to give the entire report, every answer to people to look at them and draw their own conclusions. From our perspective, what we have is half of the residents, when presented with an opportunity to rate their care home as very good or excellent, half of them chose to rate it as very good or excellent, half of them chose not to. Okay?
Yeah.
There is a message there. Notwithstanding that, even if they didn't rate it as very good or excellent, they were prepared to recommend it because 77% of people were prepared to recommend it. Whether that's a loyalty issue or whether that reflects that, you know, it's not, I don't think we're any better or any worse than anywhere else.
No.
Everybody will infer differently what that means. But I encourage you to look at the public report and the answers to the questions that are presented in the public report.
And I'll just add that with regards to the questions, the InterRI survey instruments, as well as the additional questions that were developed in British Columbia, were developed with input from residents, family members, as well as caregivers. And in testing those questions, they were found to be acceptable and important to the people who wanted us to be asking those questions. So that happened both with the InterRI development as well as their own. So sorry.
Thank
All right.
She gave you a short answer. You're lucky.
There's more detail if you want it. All right, next question from Vancouver.
Hi, my name's Laura, and I'm a graduate student at SFU, and I've also been a long-term volunteer at a residential care facility. And from my experience, I've noticed that some of the most isolated residents tend to be those who are ESL and have limited or no English abilities. And I was wondering, in your survey, were you able to include the voices of these residents? And were there any questions related to cultural and linguistic barriers in residential care and how they impact care?
So the first answer is, I'm going to refer to Lena for the numbers again, but we did translate this survey into, Lena, how many languages?
Nine different languages. And then in the end we added Italian as well. I thought that was important since we're in the Italian culture.
Yeah, where's Mario? We did, or Fabio, we did Italian. There is not a specific question about linguistics. There is a demographic question about, we will know whether that person is an English-speaking person or not. And so what we are able to do is we are able to extract the answers for all people for whom English was not their first language, as an example. And we can see if their issues, or pardon me, if their answers are any different from others. So it might reflect more higher negative scores around social engagement. It might reflect, we will be able to look at that, and we will be looking at that.
Great, thank you.
Okay.
Isabel, I have a question from Kelowna that asks, does increasing activities in your recommendations include increasing input from physio and occupational therapists?
It doesn't specifically reference physio or OT or even rec therapy for that matter. What in the full report you will read that my office is going to start reporting the RI Index of Social Engagement, the ISE part for each facility, and taking a look at that. And I think what we have to recognize is there's a strong need, and we will be further analyzing the results of those who said they didn't have meaningful activities, is that they're not looking for care. They're not looking for necessarily a physio activity. They're looking for meaningful engagement. And so I think we need to be clear that it's not just about increasing physiotherapists and occupational therapists. I think this is saying something different than that.
Isabel, the next question I have, which comes from Prince George, is did the survey capture or explore trauma-informed practice? Did the survey capture or explore trauma-informed practice and supporting seniors who have lived the experience of trauma?
The short answer is no. The survey did not do that. There are open-ended questions. There may be in those open-ended questions a disclosure of something that would lead to a conclusion of trauma, but no, we did not approach the survey that way.
Okay. I have a question from Kelowna. Compassion has been touched on, but I noticed an observation of Canadian culture versus other cultures. My nursing training in the 70s taught cultural reactions to various emotions and physical and emotional pain. Staff members in care facilities are from other cultures and do not exhibit a warmth in their interaction with residents, even though they may feel it. Will this be addressed through staff education?
That is my hope. It won't be able to be addressed absolutely. I think we would be naive to think so. But the person who asked that question has identified part of the challenge, which is the individual residents will have different expectations around what kind of involvement they want with the care aid. Some people are outgoing, some people are introverted, some people want to share information about themselves, other people don't. Part of your training as a care professional is to be able to determine what it is that the patient or resident or client that you're working with wants. but it's not going to be a perfect science or a perfect match, but I think it can get better.
All right, I'm going to turn it back to the microphone in Vancouver. You've been very patient. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Judy Chalmers, and I'm deeply involved in this subject because my husband has been in care since the end of March. He has now been moved to the special care unit because of the fact that he might have been able to climb over the balcony, and also his toileting. He is still continent, but needs assistance in being told where to go. So now that he's in the special care unit, merging abilities is so apparent because he's mobile, he's young, he's well under 80, and most people in there are in wheelchairs, they're nonverbal, and it's so depressing. I feel terrible for him.
I feel terrible for him, and I feel terrible for you.
Thank you.
That is part of that we're being driven by the needs of the system and the needs of the staff. And, you know, it's coming out loud and clear in the survey for a lot of people. That's just not working. We see it in adult day programs. There's one in Vancouver here called Paul's Club that focuses on younger people with dementia. When you go there and you experience their program and the people in that program, they are completely different from an adult day program for a 90-year-old. It's just completely different. And we're going to have to do a better job of figuring out how to care for those who still have certainly cognitive awareness and abilities in the mix. Because what happens, it's one of the things with activities. We've got to be honest here. We know what happens. So it goes to when you're creating something, you don't want to exclude anybody. And so you create the activity to include those with the highest levels of physical and cognitive impairment. But when you do that, you lose the meaning for those who have cognitive and physical function. And we're lumping it all together. It's efficient. It's the way to go. We mean well because we want to include these people. What we need to do is have one program for these folks and a different program for these folks. Some facilities do that more successfully than others, but there are limitations in smaller facilities, and I think that increasing the resources to those facilities is part of it, but making sure they're targeted where they need to be is the other part of it.
Yes. The two areas that I particularly noticed are recreation, unless he's taken out of that unit into the main area and somebody stays with him, he can't participate in any of the recreation, and there's very, very little in the special care. And also mealtime, suddenly he's got a plastic plate, mashed up food, a spoon, no napkin, whereas he was perfectly capable of eating in the main dining room, so I'm working on those things.
Yeah, and I encourage you, at the end of the day, it shouldn't be this way, but it is. There is no substitute for having a loved one as your advocate. Whether you're in a care facility, a hospital bed, a student in school, it doesn't matter. That's the reality. And so encouragement to all family members to just keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
Before we go to the next question in Vancouver, Isabel, I want to let you, as well as Sarah Darling, your Director of Communications, know that I have had a request from a volunteer to perhaps at the end of today's session to facilitate a group photo of the volunteers, wondering if people who are interested might want to assemble together and have the opportunity, and they would like perhaps to have Isabel in that picture as well.
I would be delighted if the room is thinning out here, so I don't know who's left, but if you want to muster over somewhere, I will quickly join you.
Okay, so perhaps what I would suggest is that at the end, we'll ask people to gather.
Yep, that sounds good, Lena. Thank you.
Okay, so the other thing, Isabel, just to give you a time check, is that I understand everyone has been fed and watered, and so we've been told that we can carry on till 1:30.
Okay.
So are you holding up?
I'm holding up.
She's holding up.
I just took my
shoes. Okay. So next question from Vancouver.
Hi, Isabel. My name is Becky,
And I have a close family member who works at least 40 different care facilities. And I'm keenly aware of the ownership turnover in the care facilities where, and this would be mostly in the private, where they view the facility more as a commercial business. And so, therefore, it is a little bit more profit-driven as opposed to care-driven, unfortunately. So I just want to get your opinion, Isabel, with regards to what appears to be a trend, and because I see it very clearly with the change in ownership and purchasers of these facilities coming from offshore, that the residents become a dollar figure. So just your thoughts on that.
So, Becky, I think, as I said before, when we looked at the overall results province-wide, we did not see an appreciable difference between whether a facility was owned and operated by a private company, a not-for-profit, or government. That does not mean to say that when individual facility results come out, that there may be some facilities who are engaging in certain practices, and you may see different results. But overall, we did not see that. However, what we did see was that half of the residents, 49%, reported they didn't get the same care aid most of the time, right? So that can reflect staff turnover, that can reflect scheduling people in different units in the same building, and we know that that will have a fairly significant impact on the ability of care aides to form these relationships with residents, which are key. And so I think that if you are concerned, and we will see when the individual facility results come out, if there are some where we want to go and take a look at some of these practices. Okay.
Thank you. Judy Higginbotham from Tug Story White Rock. Thank you, Isabel, for this opportunity. We've been waiting for a while when you canceled the first one, so thank you very much. I was interested in the comment that you made dealing with, residential relationships with doctors visiting and care. And my question relates to is anything come out of your study or a recommendation or even a thought on better cooperation and better relationships perhaps with Fraser Health, with some of the hospitals in the area, and with some of the, back and forth and volunteer groups that work with seniors and cooperating better in communities, not just leaving it up to the entire care facility, but reaching out. And I do know that some in our South Surrey White Rock area do that very well. Others do not, but it's almost as if it should be a line or a number or a recommendation on the interaction in the community from healthcare to volunteerism to connection with youth, et cetera. It's a big question, perhaps. Maybe you could have some ideas on it.
It's a big question, and it touches on seniors care overall, not just in care facilities, Judy, to a large extent. The challenge that we have is a very fragmented system, a system that is comprised of individuals. At the end of the day, physicians are well-meaning, and they are stretched to the limits, and there are too few of them. But they are autonomous in their practice. And so different physicians have different opinions. They have different styles. They come to their care duties with all the differences of perspective that any of us do. We have tended to want to look at coordination and connecting people. The end result, and my office will comment on this at another time in another way, but we have created a tremendous system of different people. And when you are the senior, you want the person. That's actually more important to you than the high degree of specialization that somebody might have. So you want to be able to form a relationship with your physician, not
So we have your physician, but then you get referred to the geriatrician. But they're not your physician. They're your geriatrician, right? You still have to go back to your primary care physician. And then we refer you to community physio. So now you're the physio, but these guys aren't talking to these guys. And, you know, at the end of the day, what it reflects is we want this perfect solution, this quote-unquote win-win, but it's win-win for the provider. And we rationalize how it works for the recipient. The tough decisions are for residents. The evidence is very clear, Judy. If you had one care provider, whether it's a nurse practitioner or a physician, who was in charge of that entire care home, you would have better outcomes. There are many places, but we won't make people give up their doctor, number one. And we won't make doctors do the practice, number two.
I like making better use of nurse practitioners. That makes sense to me as well. But I guess I think maybe your next area of study might be Fraser Health and or the different types of health authorities and deliveries.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Judy.
So I just need to let people know we've got two more minutes. So I'm going to allow one more question. But I do want all of the locations to be aware that we will collect all the questions and make a commitment to answering those questions via the Office of the Seniors Advocate. So the last question from Vancouver.
Thank you very much for your coming here and presenting this report. It's a very valuable report. I look forward to it in depth and how you implement it. I think you're doing a great job as a seniors advocate all around, and this is only one part of it. I'd like to ask, with regard to the care facilities, if was any question or any information gathered with regard to digital access to individuals in the care homes. Is there Wi-Fi in every care home? Is there access for people who have, who are seniors, even 90-year-olds, are very proficient with cell phones and smartphones and like their computers? Are there, if you put them into a facility like this and take that away from them, what are they going to do? They've had it at home, and then they don't have the capability of utilizing it. Is this something that could be used to help in communicating with staff and things like that within the structure? There are lots of ways of communicating between various people within the building through the digital methods that are available already.
So you've raised a good question. I know in our QuickSAS directory, we look at every facility on whether it offers cable vision or not, and I can't remember if we ask about internet or not. If we don't, we certainly could. And what we will then be able to do is look at the results from facilities that have connectivity and see if their answers are different from facilities where they don't have connectivity. But it's a very good, and not just that they offer the connectivity, but the affordability of that. You know, seniors in care homes are disproportionately poorer than the population at large. Many aren't poor. Many can afford to pay. But if you're getting internet in your home and that's all you're getting, it's like $70 a month. So we need to look at that aspect as well. But that's a very good point. And we can look and see if there's a difference because we can get that information for each facility.
I'd like to work with you on putting that forward if you are willing to have us participate in that.
We much appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
So that's all the time we have now for questions. Again, please direct all questions that have been unanswered that you may have to the Office of the Seniors Advocate. And I'm going to give you the email address, info@seniorsadvocatebc.ca. So a very big thank you to everyone who attended today's events in all of our four locations, Vancouver, Victoria, Prince George, and Kelowna, online and on the teleconference. To our volunteers and staff who ran each of the sessions at these locations, to our audiovisual team, SW Audio, for broadcasting the event, and last but certainly not least, to our volunteers who made this survey possible. Thank you, everyone, for attending, and thank you, Isabel, for your vision regarding this survey and for allowing my office to participate and contribute. Thank you, everyone, and Jeff. So I'm just going to ask Sarah to identify herself so that volunteers who would be interested in that group photo in the Vancouver location can do so now. I see there's still food on the table if people want to grab a last-minute bite to eat. Thanks again, and we're signing off from Vancouver.